I'm Josh Cooperman, and this is a very special edition of Doctoring Up Design. You know, for years, this podcast has been a work in progress, a labor of love that continually drives us to bring you solutions for your design and architecture pain points. Design, architecture, development of all sorts is a living, breathing study of how we as humans live, cohabitate, recreate, and establish domiciles and workspaces. For years, pre-pandemic, there was a time when all you really saw in the trade publications were what was pretty, stunning, new. Then, glimpses into how celebrities were living. Aspirational, for sure, but not super relatable to the rest of us. Then the pandemic hit, and all everyone wanted to know was, how do I make my dysfunctional house into a performative home? How do I fix this? Quick. Post-pandemic, much of that was implemented, and we all kind of moved away from these ideas a little bit as travel and experience took the priority. All of these things are important, but now there is a new movement currently taking place, a movement that puts the highest priority on safety and security. When politicians and their families are attacked in their own homes, when school and hospital shootings become a regular occurrence, when massive groups of people descend on retail establishments and steal so much that it registers on many of America's biggest retailers' bottom lines as shrink, we are currently in a crisis of security that affects every one of us. So we wanted to have a conversation with professionals who have been dealing with these very issues at the highest level for long enough to understand the basics and to translate these ideas into actionable steps that designers, architects, and homeowners can implement in their residential spaces, or if you're planning on building a billion-dollar school, civic center, hospital, you can look to HMC to help you do that now. The following conversation is part one of a two-part series that I am quite certain will grow into something bigger. This conversation features James Kruger, Director of Design, and Kirk Rose, healthcare practice leader, both with HMC Architects, a firm that was founded to make major contributions in the healthcare, education, and civic spaces. I mentioned two parts. This episode is being aired in November of 2023. Part two will be a live continuation of this very conversation, featuring both Kirk, James, and Sergio Lechuga, Director of Interior Design for HMC. If you are listening to this episode and would like to attend in person, please email me, convobydesign@outlook.com, and I will send you an invitation for the live session on November 16th at Design Hardware in Los Angeles, California. This is part one of our conversation. I'm excited about this conversation and the importance of it. I think it's really great. We have Kirk and James from HMC, and you've already kind of heard about what we're talking about in the preamble for this episode, but I thought this would be a great opportunity to let Kirk and James sort of introduce yourselves and the verticals that you find yourself working on most. James, why don't you go ahead and start?
Sure. Thanks, Josh. And thanks for inviting us to be here. This is a great honor. My name is James Kruger. I'm the Director of Design with HMC. I've been with the company 22 years and primarily focused on community and culture and education environments. And I'll leave it at that. I'll hand it over to Kirk.
Hi, and yes, we appreciate the opportunity very much. I'm Kirk Rose, healthcare practice leader. I'm the new guy compared to James, been with the firm 14 years. And I've also held other roles in the firm in the past, chief practice officer. So I deal a lot with, I'm a practicing principal in healthcare, but I also deal a lot with healthcare and other practices, our strategies for the markets, what's changing in the markets, what our clients are looking for, and how that's evolving over time and how we can help them.
So here's the hypothesis. that, especially since March of 2020, the idea of residential office hospitality architecture has really changed dramatically. Juxtapose that against, something that I've been saying for years, and I feel strongly about this. I believe wholeheartedly that architects and designers are futurists. I think you have to be, because you're not building a building for next week. You're not building a building for next year. I don't want to speak for you, but I would imagine that when you design a structure, regardless of its functionality, you're designing something that will have a lifespan of 75, 100, 120, 150 years. If you're a designer, far less, because the design is a bit more perishable, as as it relates to trends and fabrics and performance materials and just that kind of thing in general. The look and feel of things changes much, much more quickly, but architecture doesn't. And we're talking about this idea of industrial architecture, commercial architecture, hospitals, schools, prisons, cultural spaces, and what those in a residential environment can maybe glean from that as far as the design and how the design in these spaces are changing. Kirk, before you jumped on, James and I were talking a little bit, and I was explaining that, I'm a native Angeleno, and when I was going to school, no schools had perimeter fencing. And when my kids were at, Pacific Elementary in Manhattan Beach, when they started at that elementary school, there was no perimeter fencing. There was no turnstile. There was no safety or security measures. But you go back now, and I said they look like pretty little prisons. And James, you kind of had some thoughts on that. When you look at something like that in comparison to where these spaces were and the design when you started your career, what do you think of what it's become? How does that inform the way that you design?
It's such a hard problem to solve, right? Like it seems to change weekly and yearly and with the news cycles. And so and it seems to be getting progressively more institutional and really more about the safety of the student, which is paramount of paramount importance. But more so almost than the education component, right? So there's a danger there, and there's a real risk that our schools are slowly turning into little prisons, right? And so I feel like our job is to combat against that and to come up with really unique solutions to downplay some of these institutional components. For example, downplaying fencing, using buildings as perimeter on campus and having a fence, but setting it back, making it not the first thing you notice, using landscaping, using layers. That's like kind of job one, is to kind of, make sure security is there, make sure it's safe, but not the first thing you notice when you walk up to a campus. Having a single point of entry after the bell rings so that all folks have to come through one channel. That's a very easy thing to do, and it's something that most campuses have now. A lot of campuses we designed back in the day didn't have fencing, and now all of them do. Even in communities that historically never had fencing on any of their campuses, if you build a new campus today, they likely will have a fence. So it's a component, but it's one of a lot of different components that we need to consider when we're looking at campus design. There's other and there's a lot of bells and whistles and new technology that's out there that's going to help with a lot of these things too. There's entire wall systems that can rotate out to create safe enclosures, and there's a lot of sort of contraptions on the market that are geared towards solving some of these things. And I don't mean to downplay them. They are important, and they play a role. But I think that there's a bigger issue here, which is the mental aspect of it and behavioral aspect, and teaching these kids emotional skills to deal with things that is, I think a lot of times we see kids moving towards taking action in a negative way, and things there's a step missing of what happens when we see that and then prior to the incident occurring. And I think there's a little bit of a disconnect between behavior and action that needs to be kind of addressed. I think that's a bit to me, that's one of the bigger things that I think is missing in the equation.
Kirk, same question as it relates to healthcare facilities, because I imagine too that that environment has changed, or the planning and the approach to those environments have changed dramatically as well.
Yeah, and James may have heard some of these theories before, but I really love thinking about the future because we're in such a time of dramatic change in our society. Pandemic made telepresence a thing in a lot of ways, both for healthcare and education. And so now we've got this confluence of these institutions who, by the way, have threats to their viability, the financial viability. Higher education, especially around the US, we hear 25% of the universities are in danger of being out of business in the next 5 to 10 years. Hospitals, likewise, especially in California, have existential cost crises. 46% of them lose money, which is up from 40% before the pandemic. And we have the highest construction costs on earth for California hospitals. So, my joke is sometime in the future, a robotic drone will come and do surgery in your house. So there'll be no hospitals. But between now and then, how's it going to evolve? And we've seen telepresence and AI and robotics affect these things. We've seen surgery be able to move from inpatient to outpatient. And so it's a different building and it only costs 60% as much. And instead of a 700 square foot operating room, you can do a procedure in a 120 square foot room. And you can use telepresence to have the manufacturer of the implant device present during the surgery and watching that it's installed per their directions. So we find a lot of benefits to these technologies, and we're trying to use them as architects to help our owners build the right thing for now and try and anticipate where all this goes in the future. We see trends like all the equipment's getting smaller. So in fact, you can do more in a robotics operating room in less square feet now than ever before. A lot of our clients used to say, we need a 1,000 square foot operating room. Well, now you probably can do it in 650 and maybe smaller in the future, which is good, because the real estate's so expensive. So how do we design these things to anticipate the future technologies or seismic shifts? Like, what if physical monitoring, like what you see Tim Cook starting to bring in through the Apple Watch and many other devices, the Whoop, what if that becomes so sophisticated that people don't really need to stay in patient beds? Patient beds have been the same since the year 1000 AD. There's a hospital in England that's been open since the year 1200. They had some wards. Later, with infection control, they said, well, let's use single rooms or double rooms, which is what we do now. But that basic module could be threatened by things like physical monitoring. So stop me, because I could go on for hours about this because I'm really like excited. But the future is going to be very different for healthcare. And so one of our jobs as architects is to try and understand those things and work with our clients. And I'll just make one more comment. We just got selected a year and a half ago for a very large hospital. The owner wanted a futurist to help because they were going to spend $1 billion on a project. And they said, we want to select and interview and hire someone who can help us navigate the future so that our investment will be good for, as you said, 70 years in the future, and that it won't be obsolete in 20 or 30 years.
It's so interesting, isn't it? And by the way, I think I should also mention that this is not something that we are going to be able to come to a conclusion or any real true conclusions on in an hour. We're also going to be doing a live version of this at the D Design Hardware showroom in Los Angeles. This is going to be a series, and I'm so thankful to HMC and to Bruce for helping orchestrate this, and for you both joining in this conversation, because it's important. It's really important. The idea here kind of it was grown from, I found something online that the LA Police Department promotes, and it's called Designing Out Crime. And I don't know that it's an original concept to the LAPD, but their idea was basically, you can use design to eliminate or somehow keep crime from happening. Because I mean, If you think about this, crime in particular, and I don't want to focus just on crime, but crime in particular, the police departments across the country really are not proactive forces. They're responsive. They only respond after something has already happened. And the design industry really is, in my opinion, the industry that should be the leaders. They should be the futurists. They should be the thinkers about how to keep these things from happening in the first place. Kirk, before you jumped on, James and I were talking. This is not a political conversation, but there are places in the world where having a safe room in someone's home is not only common, but it's the same as having a kitchen or a bathroom. Having a safe room is just part of it. There are places on the planet where schools are locked down daily, where you don't have a choice about a lockdown. It just is, where, the violence in schools, the violence in hospitals keeps those spaces from performing the functions for which they're designed to function. How do you look at those topics? And James, I'll start with you in schools as the environment continues to change. How do you think about these spaces? Not the ones now, because that's a retrofit, right? But the ones in the future, how do you envision the issues prior to starting, before pencil hits paper?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of it surrounds transparency and just connectedness between spaces, between teachers and students, parents and students, parents and teachers. So, imagine spaces that are all connected both technologically and also physically, where you have pullout spaces that different activities can occur. You have visual acuity into those spaces and to the outside for biophilic connections, but also just for outdoor learning and just getting circadian rhythms in check and all those positive benefits. But having the opportunity to have movable walls and partitions that easily divide, easily movable furniture that allows for collaboration to occur. These are the types of spaces that we envision when we start a new campus. And then we get into conversations with teachers and sometimes with veteran teachers that say, well, that's too much glass and my kids are going to be distracted, right? That's an age-old conversation. And there's a lot of some education that needs to be had in terms of what we can do now to prevent that from happening, but also allow for view to happen when we want it to happen. How do you protect against an on-campus shooter? I mean, it's a sad reality. Most incidents that happen on campuses, I should say, are from within the campus. It's not an active shooter situation. It's mostly bullying or incidents that happen just on campus itself. But that said, we do need to protect against that rare occasion when somebody can come on campus and do harm. So having blinds that can, blackout shades that can come down and at a push of a button and doors that can lock, those are things that we need to factor into our design process as well.
Kirk, same question for you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be a challenge, especially considering the performative nature of the structure itself.
So we talk a lot in healthcare design in the acute care realm or medical issues, especially in places like the emergency department. Like there's a thing in public emergency departments or in emergency departments in certain neighborhoods where if a gunshot victim comes in, they can expect that if the gunshot victim's alive, whoever shot them might try and come and finish the job in the hospital. So there's a mode they get into to watch for that. And then in general, in emergency departments, we have these discussions, will a metal detector be effective? And it's not because people can rush through it. The most effective thing, it's similar to what James said, it's visual security. So normally a large security guard roaming around that everyone can see, and then an operational procedure in case somebody, an intruder comes in. But we also deal with psych patients, and psych patients can either themselves become violent because they're not, they're in an agitated mode, or there can be an incident between patients. And so we develop these designs with no hidden corners, with the supervision of staff. We try and separate out the psych patients into areas where they can be restrained if needed. And that's a need that changes on a minute-by-minute basis. They might be calm one moment, but they might be need restraint in another moment. So we're increasingly either designing a separate section. We're designing a large psych emergency department for a county hospital right now, which has an adolescent area and an adult area. So that by separating those patients out and giving them the proper supervision, we can prevent an incident. But the overall security of the facility is something they watch, because a hospital should be welcoming, and they don't want the place to be someplace you're intimidated by. So there's one other interesting discussion we had about a parking garage in a hospital. The security staff, which was the sheriff, wanted cameras everywhere. And the cameras record license plates. The hospital administration said, gee, we don't want people not bringing their family to the hospital when they need medical attention, because maybe the husband's wanted for a crime and the wife's pregnant. He doesn't want to bring his car in there because he doesn't want a license plate scanned, because he doesn't want to be nabbed by the sheriff. So these issues get very complex. We want to maintain access to healthcare, but we also want to make it safe. And so we have these very candid discussions with our clients about how to maintain the access, but have operational procedures and have designs that allow for intercepting a violent episode when it's going to happen. So it's a very, very nuanced subject.
What's fascinating to me too, I had a conversation recently with an architect, residential architect in Alabama. And he was telling me, we just were chit-chatting a little bit before we started our recording. And he was explaining to me that when he went to school, his high school, where he first learned about the concept of architecture, he never actually realized this until after he was an architect and went back to his school to speak, that his school was round. So you basically had multiple points of entry exit on the exterior, and then you had a round hallway going around the perimeter, and then all of the classrooms were pie-shaped in the center. And I thought, that's really a unique idea. It's probably not a unique idea. There are probably plenty of campuses around the country. But do you think about, be it schools or hospitals, do you think about shape? Do you think about what current use of shapes may have to do? And again, I bring this idea out because it feels like residential architecture is really kind of the experimental space and the proving grounds. You know, you're not going to experiment with a $1 billion project. You're just not, right? But you can experiment on a. There are case study homes all the time. Do you think about shapes? Do you think about space? Do you think about subterranean as opposed to going up instead going down, as it relates to the functionality of what you do, as well as the security and the external factors and forces?
I'll jump in there. So
start, James.
I'm gonna disagree with you that we absolutely test boundaries of shape and system within $1 billion projects. Kirk's working on one right now.
Yeah.
But I think that's our job, is to push those boundaries and to come up with, you know, unique and clever ideas that help to solve some of these issues. There's been studies shown that corridors that go around a corner like you're describing, or in an arc, if you will, have a ton of benefits, because you know, if you're a shooter, for example, you can't see who's around the corner, right? And that could be a law enforcement officer that's around the corner. And so that's a very positive thing on one hand. On the other hand, you have limited visual acuity if you're a teacher in that space to see what's happening down that corridor. So you need multiple people to supervise. And so there's some things that have some benefits for some things, and then, you know, negative attributes for others. But for any school campus that we design, we think very hard, long and hard about, you know, points of visual acuity, from where the staff member might be standing or sitting or on duty, to where they can see, you know, points of entry, you know, visual acuity over a quad. And maybe it's from multiple points, because the quad is the size of a football field in some cases. They're really large quads in a lot of high schools, for example. So you need multiple points, vantage points, where people have prospect and they can really have a positive impact over that space. So, when we are designing projects, we're constantly putting ourselves into those 3D models, putting on the VR goggles, and really having a clear understanding of what's happening and what we're creating that's either positive or negative that needs to be fixed. And then what we'll do is we'll bring in police officers, we'll bring in community members, and we'll do these things in a large format, big room meeting, as we like to call them. And we'll have an open, honest discussion about pros and cons, and we'll really get down into the nitty-gritty of, why are we doing this, and is this really the right thing to do for this campus?
In the healthcare area, by the way, the circular building goes back to the Panopticon, which was deemed the perfect prison because the guards could see everybody from the center. I think it was 18th century. In hospitals, we have a tough time making curves sometimes because the equipment that's laid out in patient rooms and surgery and interventional and radiology rooms, is often not efficiently laid out. And also the cost is so high per square foot, we don't want to waste a lot of square feet. But there are curved hospitals and with a similar issue that the nurses could see the patients more. And so, but that was more of an experiment in the 70s and 80s. You don't see them that much. A lot of times our building shape and size and the arrangement of elements is for the patient and caregiver flow. For example, the average nurse is in her late 40s or early 50s. They are mostly female and they walk miles and miles a day. So we try and figure out ways that they can not have hurting feet at the end of the day and have a more efficient walking path. And we try and figure out ways to get daylight deep into the footprint. So if there's a corridor, we want to make daylight at the end of that corridor or a pinwheel where there's daylight at three or four ends of corridors so that when they're working 8, 12, 16-hour shift, that they get the natural mood elevation and of daylight. And it's proven to help their job satisfaction and their productivity and their mood because they're also dealing with injured people and sick people. So their mental health while they're working is really important. So those are the kinds of things, a little more than safety. It's a little hard for an intruder to get into a deep area in the hospital because there's multiple layers. We're more worried about the lobbies, the parking garages, the emergency department, the places where the public enters directly from the outside for safety. So I don't know if that answers the question, but that we have kind of different criteria for the shape depending on whether it's a heavy diagnostic and treatment space or a patient room versus the more public departments.
Two follow-ups to that. James, you mentioned VR, and I'm curious, with the tools that you have at your disposal now, VR, AR, AI, how do you employ these new tools to help you design? And does that help you? And Kirk, I want your take on this too. Does that help you run traps, run scenarios on certain things? Like, if then, do you find yourself ever doing, I know I'm throwing a ton of questions at you, sorry, but do you ever find yourself running a simulation? Like, here is a school. If an intruder, if a shooter gets in, what happens? Do you think that way?
Kirk, I'll let you lead because I know you have a specific tool you guys use for healthcare, and then I'll.
Yeah. So we don't run simulations for shooters, although we do talk with our clients about scenario planning for different safety concerns. So there's a lot of that. And I mentioned the one in the emergency department, but it's similar to that in all the spaces we design. And a lot of times our clients ask us to talk to their other clients about their experiences so that they can kind of get a consensus. Like, for example, talk to a few of your clients. Are they putting in metal detectors these days, or are they trying to manage safety operationally? And believe it or not, the answer is largely operationally because, again, the access, they don't want to intimidate people with a metal detector. And by the way, the metal detectors are not as functional as they can be, as they should be sometimes. We do run simulations of the medical operations with technology, and I think we're going to see AI get more into that. But we have a program where we can take a floor plan in three dimensions and run different numbers of patients through it, show where the patients all stop, where the staff has to meet them, and then it spits out how many FTEs we need to staff the department, et cetera. And so those are quite useful because they want to achieve some operational efficiency. They want to reduce the number of touch points with a patient so that there's less health risks on those touch points. So we're increasingly seeing the intelligent digital twin in our design that also measures operations. There are also aspects that we're starting to measure in terms of building maintenance. So if there's an equipment in the building, mechanical equipment or medical equipment, we're starting to be able to make that an intelligent model where it'll tell you, well, you need to change the filter every so often, or you need to do a rebalance of the air every so often. And that will then automatically notify the maintenance folks. Large health systems are trying to get that to be optimized with their what we call the as-builts, which is now a digital model we turn over to them at the end of construction. But I think that's still in its infancy, but we're going to see a lot more of that where there's a in essence an AI digital twin of the building that they will be able to continually use to optimize the operations of the building. We just see a little less of that in the healthcare involving safety scenarios and more involving equipment and operations.
On the education side, there's a lot of cameras and technologies that are hitting the market now that we're all starting to hear about that have AI starting to become more of a factor. Facial recognition, rapid response systems, predictive analysis, even. And so I think as time goes on, we're going to see a lot of change happen in that space. And I think that's a really positive thing. On the design side, we're using AI in totally different ways, which has been really, really exciting. So, there's a lot of software and tools now available that help us create a set of questions about a type of building or space. And so, I'll give you an example. We did a technology center in Ghana that was a pro bono project that we worked on earlier this year. Super cool project. We didn't really know much about architecture in Ghana. We had, this is a new kind of space for us to work in. And so one of the early studies that the designer on the main project designer, her name is Shweta, out of our San Jose office, she did a series of sort of question studies of project types within a regional sort of architectural dialect or understanding get in an effort to better understand why buildings in Ghana look the way they do. And then that led her to a series of design studies that were then influenced by those sort of early questions that she asked that produced these pretty outlandish imagery. But some of them were rooted in some really great principles that then she better understood to then create the final result, right? And so using AI, so many of us use AI as a ChatGPT, glorify, search engine 2.0. It's like a better way to search and be more informed about certain topics. You can also do that with imagery, and it's getting better and better. It kind of started off as this sort of fantasy land of these crazy shapes and amorphic buildings that would could never be built. But as the tools get stronger and the knowledge base gets wider, those searches become a lot more refined to the point where you can actually do a sketch now and have it turn it into a rendering, like in front of your eyes. That's pretty darn like close to what you probably might render, which is both scary and amazing at the same time, right? So, some of these tools, I think time will tell where we go with them, but it's an exciting time to be in the profession.
You had mentioned VR, and I'm curious. What's really interesting is anytime something new comes out, you will have the early adopters who come in and try to figure out how to use it, and they'll do things. And it's the technology model for business. People rush in to use something new that's buggy and glitchy, and then they break things, and then things are fixed according to the break reports, and then it gets better, right? Which is great. You can't do that with architecture because you can't build something and wait for it to break. It has to work the first time because clients generally like when it works. And I'm curious, has VR slash AR, is that a tool that you employ? And if so, how do you use it and what does it do for you?
So for us, we like to say the first time you walk through your building is not the first time you're going to walk through your building. Like we walk our clients through their projects and we explore things and we get challenged. Like, well, why is that ceiling so high? Like, is there a reason? And so we have to have really good reasons behind all the design moves that we're making. And we try to do a good job with that. We want to make sure there's a reason for everything. And sometimes we discover things that we otherwise didn't see because we're looking at it from a different vantage point in the project, and we're realizing, oh wow, like this needs to be fixed. That's not a good line of sight, or it's too open, and we need to have a little more of a privacy concern here that we need to address. So I think it's a very powerful tool that we need to use. I think architects should be using more of. Because it really helps you and your client get your head around what exactly is going to, be built.
I can give you a tale of two VR opposite reactions by clients. And so part of my response would be it depends on the client. So we had a client in Central California, the CEO, we did a VR for him. And he was like, he ordered three sets of headphones. He had us ship up the data. He showed it to his donors and got them to donate to the project. He showed it to his staff and they all loved it and they thought it was sexy and they thought, wow, we're moving into the new century. And then we built it. Another county right now for this large project, another client for this large project, we offered them the VR and then they asked about could we do cardboard mock-ups? They had a space that was vacant. And so literally with cardboard and styrofoam chunks, we created a patient room, an operating room, an imaging room. They paid more for that than the VR would have cost. The VR would have been cheaper, but the staff wanted to feel it in 3D. They didn't care that it wasn't as photorealistic. They just wanted to test the reach of the space, the fit of the equipment in the space, the clearances, and all that stuff. So they felt more comfortable with that and they were happy with it and they gave design input on that. So I think the technology, it's like the with the generations, right? Today, everyone would not think of anything else except getting information from their iPhone, but 25 years ago, people actually would have said, I'll use a book. So it's going to take time, but eventually it'll all be a little more, I think, digital.
In that second example, was that a two scale cardboard and foam?
Full scale. They had, like I said, a vacant second floor of a library building. And so we fit out half that floor with cardboard mock-ups, full scale, to walk through.
How was that? What was that experience like for you?
Well, we've done it before, yeah, over
Okay.
the years. So, it's the contractor coming in with the 2-inch thick corrugated cardboard and cutting it with giant mat knives. And then you say, can you move that wall over a foot? And we say, well, yeah, but here's the ceiling height. It's kind of fun, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, you mean you all didn't just bring in all your Amazon boxes and cut and tape?
These cardboards were, as you can imagine, some of them were 10 by 6 feet.
Yeah.
So it had to be pretty serious stuff.
Interesting, interesting. And just to follow up to that, by doing it that way, do you think you learned anything? Did it shine a light on anything? Were there any lessons learned that you think that was the only way to learn it? Like if you had gone the VR way, you might not have seen this. Did you learn anything that you couldn't have learned another way?
That's a really difficult question because it's really not about us. I think, we've been there and done that. So when we go in a patient room mock-up, we would only notice a very unique element of it because we've seen it in various versions over decades before, some of us. But the clients haven't done this. Some of them do it once every 30 years. So you might have a doctor or nurse or a department head that's been in the business 25 years and they've never built a project. And they can only imagine the space they're in, which in this case was a very antiquated patient wing built in the 70s, which is, structurally non-compliant. So they had a blast and it was their fantasy. And in the case of the COO, the chief operating officer, she's been working on this project for 15 years until it's coming to fruition. So this is their chance to give input and to make it their dream within the constraints of budget. And so they got real excited about it. I think the physical one was more exciting to VR than VR for them because they could do it together in groups and walk through and feed off each other. We could figure out how to do that in the digital twin, but again, some people aren't ready for that. If they were all 20 years old, it might have been natural for them, but they're not. The leaders are usually older than that. So it was a real group experience, and the input was nuanced because someone would say, "What if this?" and the other would say, "Well, did you think about that?" And so within a few minutes, that exchange produced a consensus and an idea that was something that they all could agree on.
Oculus, is that what you use?
We
I
have
don't know,
used
James,
Oculus,
do
we've
we?
used
Have we?
Google
Yeah.
Glass. Yeah.
Google Glass is the one we use for my illustration.
With the new tools that are coming out, like Facebook's new offering of Glass, updated Oculus, the Apple version, which is coming out next year, do you then think about capital expense? And is that, I guess you have to think about it, but then does that become a part of your core competency? Does that become part of your the professional routine by which you operate? Because it's not inexpensive by any stretch. It's less expensive than actually building things out, I would think, as you mentioned, but it's still an expense. On the technology side, how do you select? And once you learn something, do you really want to go through the process of learning something different?
No, the only constant is change, right? So these things are ever changing, and it's another tool in the tool belt for us. So it's something that we do, and but it's dependent on client, as Kirk said. So every client's going to be different. We need to look at our forecast of what's coming up and what we think is going to be appropriate for that workload, and make the right decision. And sometimes we'll wait a cycle, and sometimes we'll invest early, depending on what it is.
You had both mentioned something at the start of this, this idea of, having a surgical procedure done by robots, machines in someone's home, or this idea now of, and James, I'm just thinking through this whole idea, economically, financially, where our economy sits right now, where our society sits right now, post-pandemic, after what's acceptable and what's not, this idea of having students, if they need to, operate in an actual virtual classroom at home that actually can look like a classroom when you have, VR goggles on. And then there's a teacher at a school 5, 10, 15, 20, 1,000 miles away, teaching a lesson, and the student is almost in the classroom, but they're at home, which if the parent doesn't have childcare, can't afford childcare, can't get their child to school 5 days a week or 4 days a week, maybe only 3 days a week, that these present options. Has that entered into a sense of normalcy for you yet, as you start to, as not as you start, as you design schools? Is that something that is a regular part of conversation?
It is. And so there's things in surrounding that make it challenging. And I think one of the biggest things we all learned, those of us that had kids during the pandemic that were attending class online, attention spans have not gotten longer over the years, right? Like, if anything, they've gotten much, much shorter. And our kids, while they did well the first couple of weeks, and they were kind of excited about it, and it's like new cereal. But that waned quickly, and we saw attendance drop. We saw kids checked out, not turning on their cameras, not interacting with their teachers. And yeah, I felt horrible for the teachers that had to survive all that. That was a really tough time to be a teacher. And so there was a big move, as we all saw, to get kids back into class and back in person. And now I think we've found some, good equilibrium where we can connect abroad and get a lecture from, a very specific subject matter expert, and have kids engaged for an hour or so, and then come back to live instruction. And I think finding that balance is the critical piece. Having it all one or the other seems to be a miss. So as we design spaces, we want to make sure that they're as technologically savvy as they are good for human interaction. And make sure that we check both of those boxes.
And Kirk, same question for you. Are your clients asking for ways? And as I think through this, right, not as an architect, as a journalist, as I think through this, and I think, if there was a room in someone's home, call it a multi-purpose room, where someone could come in, the virtual office, the virtual classroom, a virtual space that's actually set up as a quasi studio, or as a quasi hospital, or as a quasi school, or as a quasi office, can, this idea that a hospital, as part of their services, can offer a home outpatient type setting where part of their services are they send someone out to set up the space, they have a machine delivered that's actually doing the procedure with someone there to monitor in real time. I have to believe that that's something that operators are looking at now, because profitability has to be taken into consideration. Space availability, the availability of doctors and nurses, the availability of operating rooms, it all, coincides. Is this something that is in the conversation?
So if you look at the evolution of like doctors used to make house calls, right? Then after a while, it became we would go to the doctor's office because the doctor could have more appointments that way. And it became a little more on you to schedule your time at a time when the doctor was available. But it all depends on the procedure. And if you look at what's happened since pandemic, and part of it has been the insurance companies willing to be reimbursed for this. We're already getting medical care in our home when we do a telepresence appointment. We can get a therapy session for mental health. We can have a diagnosis. I'll tell you how I interface with my doctor. I send him an email, and if necessary, a photo. I've got a cut here, or I've got a bump here. Take a look. Do I need to come in? And then a lot of times I don't need to come in. So we're already doing diagnostic work that way. We're starting to renew prescriptions. What I always tell people is, do you really feel like it's necessary to go to the DMV to do a proper job getting your driver's license or your registration renewed? The answer is no. And I don't like to go to the doctor. They charge me like $30 to park now. So that part of it, the telepresence part of it, for rooms for things which don't require an in-person inspection of your body or a procedure. And then our procedures range from sort of imagery, diagnostics to interventional like surgery, or you need to stay there and be monitored like you described. So I don't see the surgery in your house happening anytime soon, but I think with robotics and drones and automation and monitoring of life of your vitals becoming more sophisticated, it'll trend towards that. But right now, it's more convenient for them to have it all in the building and for you to come there. But this kind of chewing away at it with telepresence, I think, is real and is going to continue. You also see other things being taken by competitors. So you see Walmart with their optometry in the store. And so hospitals are looking at their business model and saying, what's got to stay in the hospital versus what is, are we going to have to cede to competition? I think Amazon and Apple are looking at healthcare with large dollar signs in their mind, thinking about how can we take some of this business in a place where we don't need to own and operate hospitals, which, let's face it, it's not a good business. It's very risky. So it's a very long-winded answer to your question. I think there are many aspects of healthcare that are going to be done telepresently and are being done telepresently, and those will increase. The interface with the healthcare facility is becoming very targeted. The average length of stay in inpatient is decreasing and has been for years. The length of stay in outpatient, you can increasingly show up at 8 a.m., your surgery is at 8:15, you're out by 10 and you drive home because you're on a local anesthetic. So that whole trend is to get it out of those expensive buildings, but interface with the doctor and the equipment as much as you need to. Eventually, there'll be pills you can swallow that can probably do work inside your body, including maybe little robots that go in there and do whatever they do. So that kind of stuff, it'll be a kit that comes in the Amazon box. They'll say, swallow the pill, wear your device, and the device will pre-tell us an hour before anything goes bad. And in that case, we'll ask you to come to the hospital. So there'll be more of that kind of stuff, but I'm being a little bit, I'm not a real futurist, but I'm an amateur one. Those kinds of things aren't out of the question within our lifetime.
It's so funny, isn't it? I don't think there's any such thing as an amateur futurist. But I think, Kirk, to your point, I believe you are a futurist because you have to be by the very nature of what you
Right.
do. And it's funny because I think that this is one of those terms that is going to get a lot more ink in the coming years, because I feel like people have gotten tired of living life looking in a rearview mirror. You know, anytime something major happens, I'll give you an example. You know, anytime there is a school shooting, or you know, I'm here living in Tulsa right now, and there was last year there was a shooting in a hospital here in Tulsa. Anytime that happens, you always hear people say, "Well, you know, we're going to have to go back and look and figure out what went wrong." I think people have grown tired of that and saying, you know, it's not about your thoughts and prayers. It's not about looking back to figure out what went wrong. It's a matter of, you know, bringing smart people together to think about this and figure out how to keep it from happening in the first place. Is it unfortunate that we have to do that? Yeah, it is. Are we the first country in the world that's had to do this? No. And is it escalating at a breakneck pace? Yeah, it is. So by the very nature of the circumstances in which we find ourselves, that's why I wanted to have this conversation with you. And I think you are two of the best people to have this conversation with because you do this every single day. What is the future of this? What does it look like? Because as I listen to you talk, I almost think about, you know, schools and hospitals in a way becoming decentralized locations where, you know, they're more neighborhood focused instead of one large, huge building. You can now do things outside of that large, huge building, but the building is still there to serve when something goes wrong.
Yeah.
Is that the case for schools and hospitals? Is that the future of the architecture in those spaces?
Oh, for schools, absolutely. So, you know, the more successful campuses that we've been a part of are ones that have the principal who's going to run the campus in a very specific way involved in the early planning of the campus. And the more successfully run campuses have a really solid and deliberate way that they run those campuses. So, for example, the K-8 school that I was lucky enough to design that my kids went to was a K-8 that had the idea that they would buddy up younger and older kids to have a buddy system. And there was a single point of entry where everyone came through those doors every morning, and there was a sense of community and connectedness. And because it was a K-8, like the younger kids had the benefit of the older kids like influence, but then the older kids stayed a little bit younger, we found. Like as our kids got into junior high, they weren't quite high schoolers yet, and it kept them a little bit younger in spirit. And it was a really good sort of family-focused environment that was safe, and people were looking out for each other. And some of those mental health issues that I talked about earlier were quickly quelled and recognized. And I think the ideal scenario is that in the future we have a lot more of that, along with the measure the AI and the cameras and all the other measures that we need just to protect ourselves in the odd chance that something else may happen. But that both things together are there as a safety net to help create more just more community. And let that spill outside of the walls, and that the school becomes the place where you go to see a concert or a show, and you know, it's way more than just between 7:30 and 3:30 every day. It's a place where you go and do sports on the weekends and connect with your community members, and it becomes the heart of the community. And so I could see hospitals having that same approach. I don't know, Kirk, what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, it's already happening, Josh and James. So it used to be that the medical campus would have all treatment on it, all different types. And even if you wanted to renew your prescription, you'd go like to the main medical campus park, and then you'd go to the pharmacy, either in the hospital or the outpatient building. And what we're seeing now, partly because of this technology and partly for customer service and to obtain market share, we see that you've got to have the acute care core hospital. They've already got an investment there. It's got all the procedure rooms and patient rooms. And a lot of times you'll see an ambulatory surgery center still on the campus. In fact, sometimes we connect them because you can share functions like central sterile and you can flex cases between the two, which is a very good thing. An inpatient operating room and an outpatient operating room aren't that different in a lot of cases. Sometimes maybe the equipment's different. But when it goes beyond that, we see imaging centers and smaller medical office buildings, what we often call a doc in the box, that have exam rooms for non-invasive procedures where you're seeing somebody and someone says, I got a bunion, I got a wart, I got a tummy ache. We see those being smaller and distributed in the community. And a lot of this is a health system trying to gain toehold. So you'll see systems, UCLA, Providence, and others building small MOBs in communities where they don't have a hospital. And they're just trying to get more volume and feed their hospital with doctor-patient relationships. But those are not high acuity centers. Then you see other things like pharmacy. You know, you used to have to go to a pharmacy to renew. Now you get a text on your phone. You press one for renew or two for not, and then it comes via Amazon. So, or you go to your CVS. So it is becoming more distributed from high acuity at the core campus to lower acuity out in the communities. And some health systems are strategizing in their communities and saying, hey, we're going to build 25 medical office buildings in Southern California. And these are the areas we're targeting because those customers have our need. If they're in a specific specialty, they say, well, you know, we're going to go to Santa Monica for the cardio and ortho patients. We're going to go to these different areas because we think our specialists have target clients in those areas. So they're operating like a business that's looking to be in the market where their customers are.
So I knew this was going to happen. We're just about an hour in, so I'm at the edge, and I have more questions than I could possibly get in a single answer. But here's what I will tell you. I absolutely love this. I think this is phenomenal. This kind of exceeded what I was hoping for, and I'm excited because we're going to get together again. And this time we're going to do it in person in LA on November the 16th. So if you're watching this or listening to this, there is going to be a part two. There's going to be a link in the show notes. So if you want to come out to Design Hardware and sit in, you're more than welcome to. And we look forward to seeing you there. James, Kirk, I cannot thank you enough for doing this. And I'm looking forward to seeing you in person.
Thank you very
Thanks,
much,
Josh.
Josh.
Yeah, it's been stimulating and fun.
Thank you, Kirk and James, for your time and expertise. Absolutely amazing. And thank you, Bruce Boll with HMC, for making this incredible conversation happen. Thank you, Michelle Solomons and Avi Balsam with Design Hardware, for your continued and unwavering support of the design and architecture community. And thank you for listening to the show. As previously mentioned, if you are listening to this episode and would like to attend in person part two, please email me, convobydesign@outlook.com, and I will send you an invitation for the live session on November 16th at Design Hardware in Los Angeles. Thanks again for listening. Be well. See you next time.